I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is in Iowa and told a room of Republicans yesterday that the bluntness, directness, and straightforwardness he's known for in his state would be an asset with foreign leaders. Here's some of what he said. Vladimir Putin would never have to wonder what I thought was acceptable and what was unacceptable. And the Ayatollah in Iran would understand that there would be no negotiations with the United States of America until they publicly said and recognized the right for America to exist and the right for Israel to exist. Christie said this week his family was okay with his decision if he decides to run for president or not. Today we get an update on the governor's national moves and what's been happening in the Garden State. And let me add, it's been quite a busy couple of weeks, and we have two guests who have joined us. Matt Arco is a reporter who covers Governor Christie for the New Jersey Advance Media. You can find his reporting at NJ.com and the Star Ledger. He's joining us from a parking lot in Iowa where he is covering Governor Christie. Matt, good morning. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Jill Colvin. She's a political reporter for the Associated Press based in New Jersey. And Jill Colvin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We're going to be talking about a lot of New Jersey and Christie-related news. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Matt, let me begin with you. You are in a parking lot. What's next on Christie's agenda in Iowa today?
I am. I'm outside of where the governor is going to give his first town hall in Iowa. He is capping off a kind of a two-day tour here, maybe a little bit less than 2 days. But he came into town yesterday, his fifth trip in Iowa this year. He rolled out a policy speech on education, and then he met with patrons at a restaurant and then delivered a speech before about 150 Republicans in Polk County. That was kind of in west Des Moines, just outside of Des Moines. And now we're about 2 hour drive east in Cedar Rapids, where the governor will be arriving here kind of within the next half hour to answer questions from, I poked my head inside, it looks like about 30, maybe expecting up to 50 people here.
Based on what he's been doing, as you said, Matt, this is his fifth trip to Iowa. What are we supposed to take away from this interest in this particular state?
Well, look, you know, I think everybody would be extremely shocked right now if Chris Christie did not enter the presidential race. Yesterday, there was news that Maria Camella, his longest-serving member of his senior staff, is moving over to his leadership political action committee, I think, on Monday. So that's kind of the clearest sign yet. Really, it seems like we're just waiting a number of days, maybe just probably a few weeks, for him to actually formally announce. You know, so it is his fifth trip to Iowa this year. This is the first in the nation presidential caucus state. You know, I don't know if we'll see a ton of Christie here in the coming weeks and months. I'm sure he's going to return. But this is a state with a lot of conservative Republicans. So the idea that Christie would be a favorite here, I think, is yet to be seen. But he's certainly going to pitch himself to voters, tell his story here, as he's been doing over the last 24 hours.
Jill, you had a piece earlier this week in the Associated Press. This is actually from Manchester, New Hampshire, another important and interesting state to be visiting. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says his family is now on board if he decides to run for the presidency in the year 2016. What did he actually say?
Well, he has been saying up until now that he really had three questions that would determine whether he was going to jump in the race. And one of those was whether it was something that was good for his family. He's got two young kids at home. He's got two at college. He had been joking in the past couple of months about how his daughter, who attends Notre Dame University, might be a little bit concerned about Secret Service following her around and how that was an important factor in his decision making. And so the point he made this week was that now his wife, who recently left her very high-paying job on Wall Street, as well as the four kids, are on board with Iran. This wasn't particularly surprising. Christie had said previously that his family didn't really have any type of veto power over his decision, but I think is nonetheless one of those other signs that, you know, reporters have been looking out for, that he is indeed kind of, you know, weeks away from his announcement.
Well, in fact, looking at your piece here, he says, but the time will end this month and I'll make a decision and then we'll either be in or be out. So it sounds like, Jill, whatever he decides will be in the next couple of weeks.
That's right. So what he's doing is right now budget negotiations or not quite negotiations are going on right now. The budget deadline is at the end of the month, and the governor said that he wants to get that finished up before he jumps in.
Amanda, so interesting. Yeah, no, I hear you. Amanda, so interesting. We actually did a show yesterday about campaign finance and Jeb Bush, the kind of will he, won't he run for president. Bush apparently going to make his announcement on Monday. Chrissy, also, I mean, this has been a question mark over his head for at least a year now, it seems, about whether he actually is thinking about a run for the White House.
I mean, I think longer than that.
Longer than that, you're saying, Jill?
Yeah, I mean, there was a movement to try to recruit the governor to run, you know, 4 years ago, back in 2012. Notably, a group of Iowa business folks kind of flew down to New Jersey to try to get the governor to run. So this is something that has been part of the conversation around him for years now.
Go ahead, Matt.
You know, you mentioned kind of Jeb Bush's slow entry into the race and campaign finance. I mean, we're in an interesting time where this pre-campaign mode kind of drags on. And we're seeing with some candidates, specifically with Jeb, where in the interim, he's able to sort of, you know, you can have loose kind of association with a super PAC that's affiliated with you or kind of quasi-affiliated with you prior to announcing. But then once you announce that you're a candidate, then everything kind of gets a little bit more serious. So you have to be a lot more careful, and there's absolutely no coordination with the super PAC. So, you know, we're seeing folks who are in these pre-campaign modes who are assuring everyone that they're not running for president, that they're not candidates, and it affords them this little bit of wiggle room. You know, I think as for Governor Christie, I think they're taking special precautions to really not have much association at all with their super PAC. I think they're trying to not follow like the Jeb model there, but the same rule applies to him. So it's an interesting con with how we're financing campaigns.
Matt, you had a piece, or there was a piece in your paper that Christie, if he decides to run, and you know all this speculation, would be the least conservative of, I think there are 10 or 11 candidates so far.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Christie is has long been billed as sort of that middle-of-the-road candidate, right? I mean, he falls into the Jeb Bush category. You know, what happens when Jeb jumped into the race may have made things a little bit more interesting, right? Because you have these two folks that are going to be kind of competing for the same pot of voters now, you know, competing against one another. You know, but his conservative credentials is what kind of will call into question here in states like Iowa. Iowa is one of four early voting states, and then you also have South Carolina, where he was just what was it, last week or the week before? So you know, you have conservative voters in those areas where you know he's really going to have to sell his message. He's going to have to get there and answer questions with them and attempts to woo them. You know, I don't know if he'll be able to do that or not. So it kind of lends everything to him putting all his eggs in the New Hampshire basket. Which, you know, with the amount of trips that he's gone up there, and Jill and I have been up there maybe, what, a half dozen times in the past couple of months, it certainly seems like that's what he's doing.
Well, Jill, meanwhile, back in New Jersey, how do New Jersey voters feel about their governor?
The governor's approval ratings in New Jersey, depending on which poll you look at, have plummeted to an all-time low. It's something that you actually see amongst other governors right now who are also considering running for president. The theory being that New Jersey or, you know, state voters don't necessarily like it when their leaders are, you know, have their eyes on other pastures. But it appears from the polling over the past, you know, year or so, that the George Washington Bridge scandal really damaged Christie's standing among voters in the state. You have to remember he was coming off of just sky-high approval ratings after Superstorm Sandy sailed to re-election. But it seems from looking at some of the way that folks answer questions, that people really have questions about whether they can trust the governor now and about the way that he's been operating the state.
And Matt, where does that scandal stand today? David Wildstein did plead guilty to federal criminal charges for this, you know, bizarre lane closure at the George Washington Bridge. Where does the scandal stand today?
Well, currently we're, as you said, we had one person plead guilty. Two other folks were indicted. I apologize, it's a train going by here. But two other folks were indicted with federal charges, a former top Christie staffer, Bridget Ann Kelly, and Bill Baroni, who is a former Port Authority executive. He was appointed to the Port Authority by Governor Christie. So they're awaiting trial. And now the trial is set to get started, I believe it's sometime mid-November. So this is something that's going to be coming up. I know the Bergen Record just had a story about Bill Baroni's lawyers trying to get certain files for the case. So it's kind of percolating in the background. And as Jill mentioned, this really did damage him. It damaged him seriously, especially with Democratic voters and independent voters. They kind of fell off a little bit from Governor Christie because they, you know, that question of whether or not they can trust him. So as this is going on and as we expect the governor is going to enter the race, you're going to have the Bridgegate trial and little snippets of news popping up here or there, which has the potential to cause a little bit of further damage.
Jill, I was reading a story, David Wildstein, claiming that Chris Christie revealed grand jury information when he was U.S. attorney. Now, it's really, you know, his word against anybody else's, but it does feel as if there is a very personal, obviously very personal falling out between these two people, but that certainly raises some serious questions as well, if there's any truth to it.
Certainly. No, this is an unrelated case, and the allegation that Wildstein has made in these court documents that have yet to be substantiated, and which I should note that Christie and his office have denied, is that Christie discussed that information with members of his staff, including Wildstein, and that he also seemed to, from what Wildstein suggests, be using the Port Authority to hire somebody that he basically wanted taken out of another election, which kind of then again goes to this idea of Christie using these government offices for his own political gain. But I think what's really important here is the fact that you see Wildstein, what appears to be kind of a concerted effort to slowly, it's kind of that slow drip approach of information that is something certainly the governor would not want to be coming out as he's making these preparations. And so I think that we can probably expect over the next couple of months, both in the Bridge case as well as this ancillary case, to see similar little bits of information.
Matt, we're almost up in a break here, but how does Christie talk about the scandal, or does he?
He talks about it when he's asked about it. If reporters ask about it, he pretty much tells them, look, I'm done with this. I don't want to talk about this anymore. There's been three investigations. They've all came to the same conclusion. That's open to debate. But he says that he's done talking about it. Every once in a while, you get a question from folks at town hall meetings that ask about it. I think in New Hampshire, somebody asked about it and wanted him to explain it. And he went into this, he gave him his spiel. And in other states, I know in South Carolina, people have called the Bridgegate scandal, who've been at his town hall, kind of a bunch of baloney. So, but he says that he wants to move past it. That's what he's looking to do. So basically, anytime a reporter asks a question, that's sort of the go-to answer.
We are getting a New Jersey politics news roundup with Matt Arco and Jill Colvin. They'll be with us for another 20 minutes, and we'll be talking about some of the latest news here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We are talking New Jersey news with Jill Colvin, a political reporter for the Associated Press based in New Jersey. Also with Matt Arco. He's a reporter who's been covering Governor Chris Christie for New Jersey Advance Media. And again, you can read his reporting on NJ.com and the Star Ledger. And you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me shift gears. We've been talking a lot about Governor Christie. To you, Jill, the New Jersey Supreme Court issued a ruling over pensions this week. Can you give us an easy explanation of what the court said?
Sure. So the Supreme Court ruled this week overturning a lower court's decision about whether the governor and the administration were required to pay out the money that they had agreed to under a 2011 law with New Jersey's Public Workers Union. The unions had argued in court that this 2011 law that Christie had hailed nationally was a binding legal agreement, and that the governor was required to put this money towards the pension obligations. The Christie administration had argued, interestingly enough, that that deal was in fact unconstitutional, that they were not required to make that payment. Now, as we said earlier, the budget deadline is at the end of this month, and had the court ruled differently, it would have put the budget process into, I think everyone would agree, chaos. They would need to come up with, if you combine this year with what would have happened in the coming fiscal year, billions of dollars of funds. The governor had long insisted that there just was no money in the budget to cover this. The Democrats in the state legislature had proposed a new millionaire's tax to try to cover that deficit. But with the court's ruling now, the governor has no obligation, or says he has no obligation, to continue making their to increase the payment, which appears that it will make this kind of next couple of weeks a much smoother sailing period for him, at least.
Well, we know that all states, including this one here in Pennsylvania, are struggling with this pension deficit. Matt, where does this then leave the deal with the public employees? This was a deal that Christie had made with the public employees about the pension, and they do they have to hold up their end of the deal?
Yes, they did. And, you know, yes, this, we're going back to 2011 when Christie toured the country after the pension and health care benefits overhaul, and he touted that as a great success. But now we're in a position where he's telling, public worker unions to come back to the table and renegotiate. He wants, he's been going around New Jersey pitching a new idea for additional health care reforms. So he's saying that more changes need to be done. Now, the public worker unions in New Jersey are sort of digging their heels in. They've been critical of the governor in recent weeks. They're not really showing any signs of being willing to negotiate, most likely in an attempt to probably wait this governor out and see if they can get a better deal under somebody else. But it's, as Jill said, I mean, this was coming up to a huge roadblock for Governor Christie as he jumps into 2016, because he was going to have to come up with, basically him and the legislature would have to come up with billions of dollars that the state, either already spent or doesn't necessarily have coming in, or doesn't have coming in. So it was a serious roadblock that that the state Supreme Court kind of knocked out of Christie's way.
Did you say they would have had to come up with millions or billions?
Billions with a B.
It looks like the court, though, had some harsh words. I mean, I read sort of bits and pieces of it. Would you say that's true, Matt?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the courts were very critical of it. And as Jill said, that, his administration was sort of in court kind of saying that the law was unconstitutional. So it was just a very an interesting position to be in. If this is something that he touted, he goes on the road touting now that he's the governor that's paid the most into the state pension. So it's an interesting mix that he would tout it while also it put him on the national stage, while now he's kind of saying, well, look, we don't have the money, so I don't know quite that was the right plan. We need to do more. And, of course, the unions are saying, well, we agreed to do it with you then. What's to say that, you're not going to give us a good deal going down the road? They want the governor to fully fund the pension. And Christie's simple response, and it's basically true, is that the money isn't there in the state coffers. I mean, so he physically can't.
Let me get, looks like Marlene calling us from Medford, New Jersey. Marlene, to join our conversation. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just wanted to say that Governor Christie is campaigning on his personality and how he speaks the truth, quote unquote. I think should be judged more accurately on how he has handled the financial picture in New Jersey, where our ratings by Moody's and the other rating institutions have gone down 9 times since he's governor. Our unemployment is a full percentage point over the national average. We're the second lowest in ratings in the state, which means that we have to pay more for bonding. And he was a U.S. attorney, a lawyer. How come he didn't know that legislation was unconstitutional when he signed it before he went around the nation bragging about it?
Well, Marlene, let me put your comments to Jill Colvin. You want to weigh in on that, Jill?
I think that's a pretty astute observation. He certainly, his biggest fans believe that his personality is really what sets him apart from the other potential candidates in the field. This is somebody who is a very effective retail campaigner. He seems to be quite good at kind of winning people over in one-to-one situations, and so that's certainly something they're stressing. But even though that's their game plan, as well as, you know, series of policy proposals, his likely opponents certainly don't have the same intentions, and it's pretty clear it's already started that both Democrats and the potential Republican contenders will certainly bring up New Jersey's economic record very frequently on the trail. Now, the governor, when he's asked about things like that, typically blames the Democratic legislature for not pushing through the policies that he would like, and he frames it as an improvement over the situation when he arrived in New Jersey. But that's certainly something that you'll be hearing a lot about if he chooses to run.
Matt, let me put something else on the table here for a discussion. This has to do with the transportation needs in New Jersey. And again, like most states, bridges and roads in need of repair. I have to say that as someone that lives in Pennsylvania, when you drive into New Jersey and you see how cheap the gas is there, you know, I believe it's the second lowest tax rate on gas in the country. Is that up for discussion?
Early on, the governor was not up for the discussion with the governor, and then it slowly creeped up, and then it seemed as though it was simmering back there. But at this point, it's going to be very surprising if the governor, who's pitching himself to conservative voters across the nation, is going to go for a gas tax. So that's going to be a tough sell. But, I mean, on the issue of the Transportation Trust Fund, look, I mean, what the governor is saying, as Jill said, that he's blaming the Democratic legislature for a lot of the state's fiscal woes. You know, he's going across the nation, and he's even going in New Jersey saying, you know, if we so much of our money is going into this pension system that we need to figure out a way to cut back on that and correct that shit. And then we have money to fund these other things. So it's sort of an interesting message. It's sort of a wiggle out of an explanation, I guess you could say, of why that Transportation Trust Fund is kind of running on empty, essentially.
To you, Jill, I mean, do you think there will be a day in New Jersey where people can pump their own gas? I know that's not necessarily a political issue, but I was just wondering.
No, it's so funny. You know, when I'm traveling with the governor now, I'm always kind of taken aback when I get to a gas station and I realize that I have to get out and pump my own gas.
Right. Welcome to the rest of the world.
But, I mean, this is an issue that seems to come up every little while. It was recently floated by one lawmaker, apparently, after he arrived at a gas station and was frustrated by the long wait and wanted to pump his own gas. So it comes up every little while. But, you know, not pumping your own gas seems to be a real point of pride for folks in this state, and one of those conveniences that at least so far people have seemed pretty willing to pay for.
But, I mean, it seems, and as I said, true in just about all states. I mean, there are serious transportation needs, are there not, Jill?
There certainly are. I think anybody who's driven at all in this state, it's immediately apparent that that's a problem. And it's not just, I mean, the roads and the highways. It's a bigger problem about infrastructure in this state. I mean, you have to go to New Jersey Transit System, the PATH rail system, which is chronically underfunded, to the fact that the bridge capacity between New Jersey and New York, the tunnels and the bridges, is not adequate now, let alone for, you know, as the population continues to expand. So it's part of a bigger question, I think, about how infrastructure in the state is going to be funded going forward.
And that's Jill Colvin, a political reporter for the Associated Press. She's based in New Jersey. Matt Arco is a reporter who covers Governor Chris Christie. You can read his reporting in NJ.com and the Star Ledger. We are talking about New Jersey's governor, also some of the issues of importance to people living in New Jersey. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499, especially if you live in New Jersey. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Matt, I just want to pick up on something that Jill said about the need for either bridges, I guess, or tunnels in and out of New Jersey. Governor Christie stopped the construction of a rail tunnel under the Hudson. This was a couple of years ago. What happened there, and where did that money go?
Well, so you're talking about the ARC tunnel. I mean, that
yes.
was early on in his first term that the governor, he made the argument that New Jersey was going to get stuck with the bill or the excess cost for the ARC tunnel, which would have gone from New Jersey into Manhattan. And it was a controversial, it has been a controversial decision for years. I mean, he still, every once in a while, it rears its head, especially now that transportation folks are saying that the current systems are antiquated and we're going to need a backup plan. And the governor has said publicly in the past year or maybe 6 months that he does support a project that goes from Jersey into New York City, but it needs to not, you know, New Jersey can't be left on the hook, which is what, you know, he argued was going to happen. As far as where the money went, I mean, at the time, it went to, there was a lot of federal money that was up in the air then, but the New Jersey side of things, that money went to other areas of the budget.
Jill, let me put something else on the table for discussion, and this is such a fascinating, story out of New Jersey. Rutgers University got some government money to do seismic testing off the coast of New Jersey, I believe, to look at sea level rise. There have been some critics, environmentalists, I think members of the fishing industries pushing back on this. Chris Christie filed a complaint in federal court on Friday to stop the testing. Can you walk us through some of this?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting fight because it's kind of pitting environmentalists against environmentalists, pitting Christie along with environmentalists against the federal government and Rutgers scientists who are interested in presumably helping the environment here. So this is a project that is intended to look at sea level shifts. They blast these kind of sonic seismic rays, essentially, at the seafloor. And the project is intended to try to predict the way that the coastal movement will affect shore regions across the eastern coast of the United States to help mitigate damage in case there is something like another superstorm Sandy. But that's also raised concerns from environmentalists, from folks in the recreation and the fishing industries who say that these sound waves, which are louder than jackhammers, will disturb fishing schools there. There have been some studies about how this has affected wildlife in other places, causing mammals like whales and fish to disperse, and they're concerned about that. And so Governor Christie last year attempted to stop this from happening. It was supposed to happen last summer. The court did not rule in his favor, but there actually wound up being a mechanical issue with the boat, and so they didn't go forward with it last year, and that research began early this month, and the governor has again tried to halt that. And they're saying, at least for now, give us an environmental study that actually shows that this won't be damaging to the coastal regions.
Matt, you want to weigh in on this issue at all?
Yeah, I think Jill summed it up well. I mean, it is an interesting issue. The governor said recently that there are a lot of protesters showed up to a Governor Christie public event along the shore, and he brought them good news saying that he was on their side. I don't know that they were expecting that, but he, in his comments there, sort of set folks up to bear with the potential loss. I mean, he said that it was pretty astounding that he was fighting his own state university on this. But he was sort of setting them up for a law saying that, you know, I don't know if we'll be victorious in this.
Another thing that I want to talk about before we have to say goodbye to you, and this has to do with Common Core. I'll begin with you, Matt Arco. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was in favor of Common Core a couple of years ago. He has turned against it, and we're actually going to do a show about it on Monday. But what is his reason for opposing something that he used to support?
Yes, early on in his first term, the Common Core was something that came over from the former governor, John Corzine, but the governor said early on in his first term that this was one of the few areas where he agreed with President Barack Obama, and he was committed to it. And then as time rolled on, he flipped his position, and now he says that it's because he's listened to parents and he's listened to teachers, and none of them like it. So if he were to dig in further, that would just be him being stubborn. So he's arguing that, you know, I'm doing the exact opposite. I'm listening to the people that we've tested this, and it's just not working. I mean, the thing that's interesting about that is that obviously we know now that Common Core is this lightning rod issue among conservative voters across the nation. I've been at multiple town hall meetings out of state where voters or residents in say, South Carolina have asked them directly, what's your position on Common Core? So they want to know. The governor established a commission that's going to be coming out that was scheduled to come out with a report about a month from now that was going to dissect the issue and come up with recommendations on whether or not it was working. But his announcement just a week or so ago to dump Common Core jumped that decision. So it's, you know, depending on whether you're a skeptic or whether you believe the governor's argument, there's a couple of sides to that coin.
And Jill, residents of New Jersey, had they turned against Common Core? Were they for it in any case or against it in the beginning anyhow?
I mean, the governor says that he's heard complaints from students and parents. It seems like most of the opposition seemed to be about standardized testing, these new park exams that were aligned to the Common Core standards. And you had a lot of parents who, either because they felt like their kids were just spending too much time on test taking or for other objections, chose to keep their kids home from school or not participating in those tests, which would cost the state a lot of federal money. What's interesting, I think, though, is that at this point the governor has convened this group that will study the issue, but for now the Common Core standards are still in place in New Jersey, and these Common Core standard aligned tests are still in place in New Jersey. And so, you know, for a day-to-day level, when kids come back to school next September, nothing really changes. What this does is it allows the governor, as he's traveling across the country, to say that, you know, he's not in favor of these standards and is moving the state away from them.
Well, Jill Colvin and Matt Arco, thanks so much for getting us up to speed on some important issues happening in New Jersey. Thanks a lot, Jill.
Thank you.
And she's a political reporter for the Associated Press based in New Jersey. Matt Arco, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. He's a reporter who is actually in Iowa right now, reporting on Governor Christie for NJ.com and the Star Ledger. Waiting in the wings, we have John Micek. We're going to be shifting gears and talking about the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, what's been happening here, including Governor Tom Wolf's battles with the legislature. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Tom Wolf is facing his biggest test as Pennsylvania's new governor, with the deadline for his $30 billion budget just weeks away. Republican leadership don't like his tax on natural gas drillers with the money earmarked for the Commonwealth schools. They also didn't like his nominee to head the state police, Marcus Brown, rejected by the Senate this week. And Wolf is in a battle over the previous governor, Tom Corbett's appointment of Eric Arneson to head up the Office of Open Records. We asked John Micek to get us up to speed on these stories and more. He's editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and for Penn Live. John Micek, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning to you and to our listeners. Again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499, talking about Pennsylvania politics. Also, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. John, Governor Wolf is not the first governor to face a kind of a showdown with the legislature. It happened with Corbett. It happened with Rendell. It's probably happened with governors before that. Is it ideological differences, philosophical differences, or just kind of habit that the legislature is going to push back against what any governor is going to propose for a budget?
Well, Marty, you're right. This is probably a week that the governor is happy to see the back of. It was rough to say the least, but you know, we've been through, or rather, I've been through a few budget cycles here, and this one seems slightly different to all the rest. To be sure, there are always disagreements between administrations and the legislature over budgeting priorities. There are 253 men and women in the General Assembly, and as a consequence, you have 253 different opinions on how the state should best allocate its money. During the Corbett years, with Republican control of the General Assembly and the governor's office, there was slightly more unanimity of thinking, but again, there was still, you know, widespread disagreement. You remember in the first Corbett budget, the governor wanted to cut higher education by 50%. There was massive backlash there, notably from now Majority Leader Jake Corman, whose district includes Penn State, and they walked back the cuts there. So even when there's one-party control of the General Assembly, there not always unanimity of thinking on how money should be spent. That said, with the Wolf administration, the two sides are coming probably farther apart ideologically and philosophically than we've seen since the beginning of the Rendell years, which makes the lift quite a lot harder.
Well, and what he's really asking, part of this budget, is restructuring how taxes are paid in Pennsylvania, raising the income and sales tax to offset some property tax relief. I mean, that's sort of in the weeds, but at the same time, it's also a very different approach to how the Commonwealth raises revenue.
That's exactly right. Whereas in some past budgets, they've looked at revenue enhancements. What we're looking at here is the wholesale overhaul of the state's tax system. You know, you have some Democrats who aren't thrilled with the governor's proposal to expand the base and the items that are covered by the state's sales tax. You have Republicans who aren't thrilled about the idea of leveraging a severance tax on natural gas drillers. You know, both sides might have problems with a personal income tax hike. So when you start talking about these widespread structural changes, it gets a lot harder to reach consensus.
I remember Governor Wolf, when he was a guest on the show a couple of months ago, was talking about the fact that he was spending time, I think, visiting every office of the legislature, talking with staff and talking with the representatives in Harrisburg. Do they operate out of friendship, out of fear? What is an effective negotiating style with the legislature in Harrisburg?
I guess we're about to find out.
I guess so.
A crop of new leaders and an entirely new administration. Certainly the governor will be served in good stead by those visits he made very early on. But I doubt any Republican legislator who's dead set against a personal income tax hike was going to say, well, geez, you know, Tom Wolf stopped by for a cup of coffee. I've seen the light. I'm going to vote for his proposals now. But, you know, those kinds of one-on-one relationships always help. I mean, we've seen a fair bit of sniping back and forth across the battlements between the Senate Republican leadership and the administration. So it's just that it's going to be as confrontational as ever. We're not quite into the thick of things yet, but we'll have to see how that transpires. I'm sure there'll be the standard round of temper tantrums and toys being thrown under the flame as there are with every budget negotiation.
I'm interested in those toys that get tossed around. But it seems like the heart of the disagreement has to do with this severance tax on natural gas and using some of that revenue to pay for education in the state. Would that be right, John?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, what we're already starting to see, Marty, is an attempt to sever the debate over property tax reform, over the debate over raising revenue for the general fund. You know, there are Republicans in the General Assembly who don't want to see any money raised from a PIT increase or a sales tax increase go into the general fund. What they want is a dollar-for-dollar reduction in local property taxes. The governor's proposing something like a 50% reduction in local property taxes in exchange for those new revenue sources. So there is a philosophical difference there. So that leaves the severance tax, which, as you correctly note, you know, a lot of lawmakers have trouble with. The governor, quite cannily, I think, has nominated a guy named Andrew Place. And this is the topic of a column that just went live on 10live.com, a gratuitous plug, who is an executive with EQT Energy in Pittsburgh, so he's now actually tapped a shale industry executive for a spot on the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission.
Oh, interesting.
Which is, you know, apparently the right kind of shale executive to tap for the PUC, because I can only imagine the reign of frogs and rending of garments had we substitute the name Corbett for Wolf in that headline. But he will have someone who now speaks fluent shale and can kind of serve as an intermediary to the industry as he seeks to build support for this tax proposal as we get into the thick of budget season.
Interestingly, House Speaker Mike Terzai said this week, actually, that this severance tax would cost jobs. It would hurt the natural gas industry in Pennsylvania. And I was wondering, I mean, where would they go? I mean, the gas is here.
Yeah, so that's kind of a greatest hits of Republican complaints that we've been hearing since the beginning of the Corbett years and even into the latter part of the Rendell administration when they first brought up the idea of taxing shale. The one thing is that you can't raise as much revenue as you would hope from a shale tax right now because natural gas prices are so low. There has been a decline in some drilling activity in some parts of the Northeast, but, you know, you're correct. It's not as if they're going to hop over the border into Ohio and sort of horizontally dip a straw into our natural gas and draw it out that way. The drillers will not pack up and leave. I've always found that argument to be a bit of a red herring.
And this is something, obviously, that Wolf campaigned on. But it sounds like what you're saying, John, is that there probably isn't the money there that he would hope would be there, assuming this was passed, to go to the schools?
Well, I mean, the governor had originally said that he hoped to raise $1 billion from a 5% severance tax, and that was based on prices at the time. Prices are lower than what they were when Governor Wolf was candidate Wolf. And the projections we're seeing now, I think last time I checked, we're somewhere in the neighborhood of just shy of about $700 million. So they would have to adjust, you know, whatever money they wanted to drive out to schools accordingly.
Well, still a lot of money. Let me reintroduce you. That's John
Micek. It is not chump change, to be sure.
Indeed. And that's John Micek, editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and Penn Live, getting us up to speed on some of the budget negotiations happening here in Pennsylvania. And we will be talking about some of these nominations that have run into some headwinds. And you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We do this every couple of months or so, just to get us all up to speed on what's happening here locally, whether it's in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, or Delaware. 1-888-477-9499. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. John, let me ask you about this Pennsylvania State Police nominee, Marcus Brown. He was rejected by the Senate this week. Tom Wolf had put his name out there. What happened?
Well, I mean, that was just there were a whole constellation of factors that went into the derailing of the nomination of Marcus Brown. There's the debate over his decision to wear a uniform blouse for the state police when he had never attended the Pennsylvania State Police Academy. Retired and former troopers and even some current troopers had raised a ruckus over that because in defiance of their longstanding tradition. There are questions about a pension payout he took while he was a Baltimore City officer, property tax, homestead exemptions he took while his wife lived in Pennsylvania and he lived in Maryland. What am I leaving out there? I mean, there's a sort of a host of issues that conspired to blow that up. And we saw all of that come to a head on Monday afternoon in the Senate. The governor actually tried to withdraw Commissioner Brown's nomination. The Senate said they would only honor that recall petition, as it's known, if the governor promised not to resubmit his name for confirmation again, so they could sort of like, you know, lobby and build support. The administration said no dice, so the Senate plunged ahead with a confirmation vote and rejected him on a party line vote. We had three Republicans, Stu Greenleaf and Dominic Pileggi from down your neck of the woods, and Senator Patricia Vance from Cumberland County out here, who actually crossed over to vote in favor of Commissioner Brown. Governor Wolf has left him in there as acting state police commissioner, but under sort of the vagaries of the law, they have to resubmit his name for confirmation, I think within 30 days, if memory serves, so we could be going through this whole circus again, or they could just remove him and try to find a more palatable candidate.
So we're talking about conflicts over a shirt he wore, or I guess a uniform shirt, I should add, over yard signs, a pension, as I read.
That's right. I forgot the yard sign thing. And, that's right.
I mean, did he have credentials beyond all this to be the head of the state police in Pennsylvania?
Well, if you listen to his Democratic supporters, they say, yes, that he started out as a Baltimore beat cop and walked the streets of that city, and that he'd made efforts to diversify the Maryland State Police when he was appointed commissioner by former Governor Martin O'Malley, and that he does, in fact, have the law enforcement bona fides to lead the Pennsylvania State Police. But we got caught up again in this sort of constellation of side issues that his critics used to raise questions about his character and about his professional judgment, particularly the yard sign incident, which is tied into the uniform shirt thing. This group calling themselves "he didn't earn it, he shouldn't wear it," placed yard signs around Commissioner Brown's, they were around the bus stop, rather, where Commissioner Brown's kids waited for the bus, he saw these, and he says, you know, the father thing kicked in, and he ripped him out and took him out of the ground and put up, shoved him in the back of his cruiser and drove off. This ended up being something of a trap because the guy was laying in wait with a video camera to catch him on film doing just that. It was found that there's no illegality about his removing the signs, but his critics pointed to that as signs of, you know, of a temper. How would he deal with more and broader legitimate criticisms about things that would happen with the state police, for instance?
And I do want to talk about Eric Arneson, but John, I mean, was this just a way of putting the governor in his place?
It certainly seems that way on the part of the Senate. I mean, the governor asked to have the it was kind of a power play all around, frankly. The Senate asked the governor to not resubmit Commissioner Brown's name for confirmation again. The administration said, no way, he's our boy, we're going to do it again. And you had the staring contest, and that's continuing there for insofar as they can keep Commissioner Brown as an acting commissioner.
Well, let me put another name out here for our discussion now. Tom Corbett named Eric Arneson to head up the Pennsylvania Office of Open Records. He did this right before leaving office. Governor Wolf objected to how this decision was made. There was a court decision earlier this week. What did that court say, John?
This is a ruling by the state Commonwealth Court arguing that the governor did not have the authority to remove Mr. Arneson as the director of the Office of Open Records, that he'd been duly sworn in, and that in any case that the office should be immune from these sort of political machinations because it's supposed to be independent and it's supposed to be able to hand down decisions the administration may not necessarily agree with and still be immune from any sort of external political pressure. The administration has appealed to the state Supreme Court, claiming that that the lower court erred, and this is really about the governor's ability to appoint people that he sees fit for the position. The Wolfies were quite upset when Governor Corbett made the Arneson appointment out the door. They claimed they weren't consulted and that this appointment should have been left to them. At my place this week on Penn Live, we editorialized calling on the administration to withdraw its appeal, arguing that enough time and money had been spent on this process already, and frankly, there are bigger fights yet to be fought.
In fact, I believe the Philadelphia Inquirer had an editorial today basically saying the same thing. There seems like there's a lot of pressure on the governor to just let this go and move on. John, based on what you know, does that seem like something he might do?
Since Jeff Sheridan, his spokesman, told me they had no plans to do that, I'm going to take them at their word. Marty, you know, we can editorialize all we want, but they are convinced that they are in the right on this and are going to plunge forward, which I find unfortunate, frankly, and sort of a waste of time and money, you know, that could be directed to other programs.
We're almost out of time here. The legislature also voted this week to criticize Governor Wolf's moratorium on the death penalty. In 20 seconds or less, John, what did they say and why did they do it?
They say it's unfair to victims and the governor doesn't have the authority to do it. The state hasn't carried out an execution since 1999 anyway, so this whole debate over the moratorium seems largely academic. We've had one for, you know, at least 16 years.
Well, on that note, always a pleasure. John Micek, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and for Penn Live, getting us up to speed on what's been happening here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to follow us on Twitter, how to find us on Facebook, how to get our newsletter, how to listen to us on satellite radio. It's all there. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.